You know what? We are in our second week of a series called Questioning Christianity. And today we come to a very challenging question. Skeptics ask hard question. That is, how can a good God allow so much suffering? How can a good God allow so much suffering? And guys, you know that this is a real question. And you know, some of you know, most of you know that our family, I have been on a bit of a journey myself in terms of suffering. And in fact, this week, this was brought home to me again. I drove up to my favorite pizza restaurant, Red Rosa, and I saw this sign. We are closed. Closed, called there, closed permanently. And what did I say? Why, God? Why do these things happen? Seriously, though, there's a lot of suffering that happens around. And for some reason, I got launched back to about 5 years ago. I was in Panama, and I've had a chance to visit the Panama Canal. And before that, I read about the making of the Panama Canal. And here's the interesting thing about this. In the late 1800s, the government of France, decided they're going to build a canal, and they attempted to do so for several years. It was a miserable and utter failure. The engineering was all wrong, and worst of all, 22,000 people died. 22,000 people died, and they were mostly locals, and they died of malaria and yellow fever. So the French pulled out. It almost bankrupted the nation of France. Years passed, and Theodore Roosevelt became the president of the United States, and he said, let's have another go at it. And just the short version of the story is they said, we need better engineering. And then there was a medical, which they had, and there was a medical officer who said, and we've got to reduce these 22,000 deaths. We can't have that. That's not acceptable. And so this medical officer said, if we're going to do this project, the only way I will agree to it is if we control the mosquito population, right? And everyone said, well, that's really stupid. Why would we need to control the mosquito population? And he said, well, there's this new theory that the mosquitoes are actually causing the yellow fever and the malaria. And of course, everyone knew at that time that that was a joke and was not true, because everyone knew that it was the dredging up of the dirt that released vapors into the air, and the vapors were what was making everyone sick and dying. But he was firm. He said, absolutely not. I'm going to hold my ground. And eventually they caved to him. And they said, okay, whatever. You want to kill your mosquitoes, fine. And he did. And of course, the deaths plummeted. And the canal was built. And it was just a huge success. Not to say that there weren't people that died. But comparatively, it was greatly reduced. There's two things I learned from that little episode in history. First, what do we know about humans? They suffer. And secondly, they initially assume that if they don't understand something, it cannot be true. Now, I want to talk about both those. They suffer. Now, that was one thing. That was a lot of death and disease. But in a room this size and with this many people, if we went around and heard, there's a tale of suffering and woe and hardship in almost every person's life, whether your own life or someone you love or someone you care about. We could name it. You know, there's disease, there's death, there's suffering, there's emotional hardships, there's financial hardships, there's psychological issues, there's relational issues, there's heartache, there's heartbreak. And we could go around and hear all of those. And then you add on to that all the natural catastrophes and disasters that happen in the world. And you could keep multiplying all the evil and wrongdoing that is done in this world. And it just kind of piles up. And a lot of people say, well, you know, if all this happens, then how can God be loving? How could a good God allow so much suffering? And a lot of people feel this just torpedoes the Christian faith. Now, the second thing is we're going to get to some options we have. But what I want to say to you is, no, keep going back to that last one. Okay, there we go. Okay, they initially assume that if they don't understand something, it cannot be true. We're going to share some things that it might be difficult to process through. But it doesn't mean they're not true. It just takes some time to process, okay? So give yourself some space. And this is not the end of this discussion. It's just a beginning of begin to think about these things, all right? Begin to process these things, okay? Fair enough? Fair enough? Yeah, all right, great. All right, so let's talk about this. What are the options that we have? And I'm going to talk about three main options. I think these are the three main options. The first one is what are our options for understanding suffering? First is that we just suffer without God. We say there is no God. That's atheism. Secondly, we say we alleviate suffering, our own suffering, by becoming detached. This is the answer of Buddhism. And we'll get to that. And it's the one religion that really centers in on this as well. And then Christianity, Christian worldview, is we experience suffering in Christ. That there's some way that our relationship with God helps us to experience suffering in a redemptive way, in a way that makes sense. So let's talk about the first one, and that is atheism. And we're going to learn in these three that I believe, at the end of the day, is that we're going to learn that suffering is not the wrecking ball that knocks Christianity down, but rather suffering is the cornerstone on which Christianity painfully, brick by brick, is built upon and has always been built upon. So Christianity tackles it head on. But let's first consider atheism. This is suffering without God. I'm very grateful for a book, for this portion on atheism and Buddhism of this message. I'm very grateful for a book by Rebecca McLaughlin called Confronting Christianity. And she says, for some, about atheism, for some, removing God from the equation promises relief. Suffering happens. There is no meaning. There is no reason, no hope. So we can stop trying to read the tea leaves. At first, she says, this may seem like a mature approach. Make what meaning you can out of your life and don't expect a higher power to help or care. Stephen Hawking, who lived with a debilitating motor neuron disease for his whole adult life, believed the brain is a computer that stops working when its components fail. Quote, he said, there is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers, he declared. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. Many atheists today anchor themselves on humanism, believing in the human spirit and a capacity for progress, creativity, and love without any need for the God hypothesis. However, Richard Dawkins, the atheist's relentless chain of there is no design, there is no purpose, there is no evil, there is no good, is actually sound and makes sense if you adopt the atheistic perspective. The ironic thing about atheism is not only eliminates God from the equation, it really eliminates humanity from the equation. You're not a human person. You're just a machine. You're just a thing. Your suffering means nothing. Your life is meaningless. It has no purpose. There's no overarching. It just happens. It just is. Your life is as meaningful and as purposeful, and the suffering you go through, according to atheism, is just as meaningful as a rock on top of a mountain that dislodges and just rolls down the side of the mountain, hitting various things along the way. It just happens. Now, some atheists will try to salvage and say, no, wait, there's still ethics, and there's still, the universe has meaning, and they try to construct that. But guys, listen to the real atheists. Because that view that it still has meaning and there's still ethics and so forth is simply a shell game that moves things around that wants you to forget that all of those, that meaning and value came from the existence of God. So they want to take the meaning that it has and borrow from that, but let's keep God out of the picture. And it just doesn't work. And the honest, consistent atheists know that this is true. Many people want to hold on to that who don't have a faith. And she writes about this a few years ago. Rebecca McLaughlin says, I was walking through suffering with a dear non-religious friend. She talked hopefully about the universe having some kind of plan. Because I loved my friend, I pleaded with her gently not to reach for that placebo. Placebo is something that looks like the real thing, but it actually is just fake. Don't reach for that. If there is no God, we still suffer. But there is no universe to care about you. There is no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. We must stare into that abyss and not fool ourselves with platitude, for way too much is at stake. The second approach is the Buddhist approach. And it's interesting, an atheist Jewish psychologist by the name of Jonathan Haidt wrote a book called The Happiness Hypothesis, and he was trying to figure out, he thought, well, maybe Buddhism is the answer. And Buddhism is kind of the hip, trendy choice among some burned out Westerners, and they kind of change it around a little bit, but it is a popular option. And he writes in the book, when I began writing this book, I thought that Buddha would be a strong contender for, quote, the best psychologist of the last 3,000 years award. To me, his diagnosis of the futility of striving felt so right, his promise of tranquility so alluring. But in doing research for the book, I began to think that Buddhism might be based on an overreaction, perhaps even an error. And so he recounts the Buddha's story in this book. And by the way, just so you'll know, you know, I graduated from Trinity Seminary in Chicago, a wonderful Christian seminary. But my undergrad was at Indiana University, and my major was religious studies. So I studied all these various religions most of the time from practitioners. So I'm familiar with these other worldviews and have heard them from people that are passionate about them and who clearly articulate them. So tell the story. The man who became the Buddha was a prince. This is how this story is told. But a prophecy declared that he would one day leave the palace and turn his back on the kingdom. To avert this, the king, his father, did everything in his power to keep his son happy. The young prince married a beautiful princess, was given a stunning harem, and was prevented from leaving the comforts of the palace. But he grew bored and eventually persuaded his father to let him go out in a chariot. To ensure that his son continued to avoid unhappiness, the king ordered all his aged, sick, and disabled subjects to stay at home. But one old man remained on the street, and the prince discovered that everyone ages. The next day, the prince saw a sick man and discovered disease. On the third day, the prince saw a corpse and learned to his horror, everyone dies. As predicted, he left the palace then and entered the forest to begin his journey of enlightenment. And when he emerged, the Buddha proclaimed that life is suffering and that the only means of escape is to break the ties of attachment that bind us to life. The reason why you suffer is because you care about this. You're attached to this person or this thing or whatever. You need to break that attachment, and you do that through following the Eightfold Path and so forth. And what happens is, it's very an ethics-based, so you kind of, karma is you get what you deserve. It also says that, you know, if you follow this path, you will be reincarnated and everyone will continue to this endless cycle or almost endless cycle of reincarnation until finally, you finally come to the point after however many cycles of reincarnation that you can break loose of this suffering world, and you're kind of like the mist in an ocean, and you become absorbed into Mother Sea and just get absorbed into the divine essence. And that's the purpose of existence, and there's no more suffering. And that is Buddhism. Haidt, that psychologist that wrote the book, asked an interesting question. What would have happened to the prince if he had simply left his chariot and spent time talking with the aged and disabled and sick? He cites research in this where he says, even people that live in desperate circumstances, they may have painful lives, but their lives have meaning and significance, and many of them are happy, even in the most difficult of circumstances. So what if, rather than detachment being the answer, actually engagement is the answer? Like relationships is the answer. Non-attachment may shield us from suffering, for to love is to be vulnerable. To desire and strive is to risk disappointment. But non-attachment also deprives us of our greatest joys. Striving, desire, and deep attachment can lead us to the brink, yes, but can also bring us treasures that non-attachment will never find. So is there a third option? And of course, that's the one we turn to now, and that's Christianity. Now, 3 years ago, I gave a message on why does a loving God allow so much suffering? And in that message, which we'll post online, I kind of did a Genesis to Revelation approach and covered a lot of territory. We had a triangle, and the triangle was of three truths. God is loving, God is all-powerful, why is there suffering if those two are true? And we kind of walk through that in a Christian worldview. And we're not going to do that today. And if you're interested in that approach, two things. We'll put a video online. And also, here's just one example of a book called The Problem. It's called The Problem of God by Mark Clark. And you can pick it up at the guest services today. And there's some information about that. There's a lot of other questions he deals with, but he deals with that one. For more of that kind of overarching. Today, I actually don't want to do that. I actually want to just look at one story in the Bible. And what I want to do is I want to just pull out from this one particular historical account threads, themes, mega themes of the Bible that deal with the issue of God's goodness and love and suffering, and see what we can draw from them. We're not going to answer all the questions. In fact, I'm going to compare it to like a hand. Like, here is reality, and we're only going to get like the palm of the hand, and there'll still be some fingers that you're like, but what about it? But there's enough there for us to hold it together, all right, to have it here, all right? And God, I think you'll see that suffering is not the wrecking ball, but it is the cornerstone on which Christianity has been always been built, all right? So let's look at it together. It's in the Gospel of John. So Jesus, one of his closest friends, wrote this, and it's John chapter 11. So if you have a Bible, you can turn there, or you can Google that, or use the YouVersion app, or you can just follow along the screen, and we're going to walk through this whole story. Now, guys, I am not going to explain or defend things. I'm just going to present them. Something to think about. Something to take in, all right? So let's walk in, all right? Here we go. Chapter 11, John's Gospel. It's a story of Jesus and his very good friends, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. And something very, very terrible happens in this particular chapter. Now, a man was sick. Lazarus from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Mary was the one who anointed the Lord with perfume and wiped his feet with her hair, and it was her brother Lazarus who was sick. So the sisters sent a message to him, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Here's three things I learned from that so far. Number one, suffering is real. Christianity does not teach that suffering is an illusion. It's a real thing. It actually happens. It's not a figment of your imagination. It is brutally realistic about suffering. Suffering is real. Bible knows that's true in your life and mine. Secondly, God loves people. The one you love is sick. So he's invested. He cares about our suffering. He cares about us. And he has friendships and relationships with us. And thirdly, we expect him to do something about it. She wasn't reporting, "Lazarus, the one you love is sick," as just kind of like a, "just wanted you to know, just check that off the box," like a chart or something. No, the implication is, do something, Jesus. And the Bible totally allows us, and in fact, expects us to expect him to do something about it. We're leaning in on you. Come on now. The Bible's good with that. Verse 4. When Jesus heard it, he said, "This sickness will not end in death, but it is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now just hold on for just a second. Verse 4 here, just like circle the whole verse, because this is one of the most important verses about suffering in the entire Bible. Read it carefully. "This sickness will not end in death." Hey, wait a minute. Who dies in this story? Lazarus. Spoiler alert. Okay. "Will not end in death." That's important. That's not the end of the story. But there's a purpose, for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. So there's some purpose to this. I don't understand the glory of God and the Son of Man be glorified. They didn't either. It's like, what are you talking about? I don't totally get that either, but we're getting there. So what do we learn from this? We learn this. God is sovereign. He is in control. He knows what's going to happen, and he's overarching, ruling all things, and has a design purpose. This is going somewhere. You're not a rock tumbling down the side of a mountain. There is a purpose in this, right? Many years ago, Rabbi Harold Kushner wrote a best-selling book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he said, if God is all loving and God is all powerful, then why do bad things happen to good people? And he concluded in the book that God is all loving, but that he is not all powerful. In fact, he can't handle it. He doesn't know what to do about the suffering. In fact, at one point in the books, he said, we should pray for God so that he gets schooled on this a little bit better and learns how to deal with what's happening in the world. This is such an incredibly low view of God and has nothing, it is not a biblical worldview. God is sovereign. He is in control and he has a design purpose. He's going somewhere with this. And it's this thing called the glory of God. And so one hint for us is to learn about that, because that's an important thing. In fact, the Westminster Catechism of Faith, written many centuries ago, asked the first question in the Westminster Catechism is, what is the chief end of man? What is the goal of our existence? And the answer is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. So somehow those are not separate, they're together. We glorify God and we enjoy him together. There's something, the glory of God and our enjoyment of him and a relationship with him forever is our end goal. I think it's a great question, and that's what this is hinting at. There's more to it, but that this is an important thing to understand. There is a purpose, which I may or may not totally understand, but there is a purpose. Okay, keep going. Verse 5. Now Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed two more days in the place where he was. Wait a minute, that's wrong. He heard that he was sick, so he rushed to his bedside immediately to see what he would do for him and make sure nothing bad happened. That's where I think the story's going. But he says he loved them, so he waited two more days. Here's the principle. Mysteriously, God sometimes loves us through delay. Mysteriously, God sometimes loves us through delay. He doesn't always give us what we want when we want it. And the Bible is very clear about that. And I kind of sort of get that, because guys, how many of you have, you know, have our parents maybe, you know? Yeah, so how many of you as parents didn't always give your children exactly what they wanted when they asked for it? Anybody here, or did y'all just, yeah? No, we understand. Sometimes in your wisdom, you gotta have a long game here. There's something else going on. There's other values that are higher than just giving that. Sometimes we give it to them because we're tired of their whining, whatever. But God is infinitely patient, and so he can put up with our whining forever, eternity. So he gives us not always what we want when we want it. Okay? All right. Then after that, he said to his disciples, so some time passes, let's go to Judea again. So we're going to go there after some time. Rabbi, just now the Jews tried to stone you. You're going to go there again? Aren't there 12 hours in a day, Jesus answered? If anyone walks during the day, he doesn't stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks during the night, he does stumble because the light is not in him. I have no idea what Jesus just said, and neither did they. But I think generally what he meant was, I'm here for a purpose and a reason, and it's to be light, and now's the time. Verse 11, he said this and then told them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm on my way to wake him up. Spoiler alert, Lazarus has died. Here's what we learn from this. Jesus is all powerful. He knows Lazarus is dead, but I'm going there to wake him up. Not a problem. I'm in control. I can do anything. He is all powerful. This is absolutely what the Bible teaches about God and Christianity holds to. Well, then the disciples said to him, Lord, well, if he's fallen asleep, he'll get well. You know, sleep is good for sick people. They need their rest. So let's just stay away and let him get some rest and he can recover. Jesus, however, was speaking about his death, but they thought he was speaking about natural sleep. So Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, period. Here's what I learned. Death is real. The Bible has no fantasy about this. Death is a real part of human existence. In fact, we don't have time to go there, but if you go back to Genesis 1-3, you see the entry of sin and death into the story. And so it's all part of the mess that we're in, and that God is rescuing us from. But death is real. The Bible doesn't paper over that. Keep going. And then he says, Lazarus has died. Here's the next words. I'm glad. What? Hang on. That's the next two words. Lazarus has died. I'm glad for you that I wasn't there. What? How uncaring. This is a terrible person. So that you may believe, but let's go to him. No, he's got another plan here. There's something going on here. What is it? God's ultimate goal for us is to fully trust in him. There was something else that God was going to do in this circumstance. He says, he's died, but I'm glad for you. Because the outcome of this is you're going to believe in me. You're going to trust him. So God's goal in our lives is for us to fully trust in him. Because why? Because the most important relationship you have with it is God. Okay. Then Thomas, called the twin, he's also called something else. He's called what, Thomas? He's called Doubting Thomas, okay, said to his fellow disciples, let's go too so that we may die with him. This is going to be a disaster. We're all going to be stoned to death, but let's go back. Jesus is our master and we follow. So he's a very courageous guy, highly pessimistic, but he's a realistic guy. And here's the thing I learned from this about the Bible's worldview. Some people are realistic downers. They're just Debbie Downers. And guess what? The Bible allows people to be that way. In fact, this is one of the 12 top leaders of the church. He actually took the gospel eventually to India, did Thomas. So the Bible's okay with people having questions and like, wait a minute, this is gonna end in a disaster. This is gonna be terrible. It's okay, the Bible can handle it. Jesus can handle it, God can handle it. Verse 17, when Jesus arrived, he found that Lazarus had already been dead in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, less than 2 miles away. Many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them about their brother. As soon as Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him. But Mary remained seated in the house. Then Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Here's what I learned. Sometimes Jesus doesn't come when we want. The Bible very plainly states this and affirms this. We have our expectations, we have our disappointments, we have our heartbreaks, and sometimes Jesus doesn't come when we want. He doesn't go by our timetable. Verse 22, yet not even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. She's kind of saying, oh, I didn't mean to hurt your, insult you or anything. I know you're still in charge. It's okay. Jesus told her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. There is hope in suffering, but it seems far off sometimes. And it does. In our humanity and in our perspective, yeah, I know that's out there, but boy, I'm living here right now. And it's hard. Verse 25, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me, even if he dies, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? And here's where the story takes a turn. Because now, Jesus reframes our suffering. Up to this point, here's how I want to look at this situation, Lazarus, that my suffering, my hurts, my heartaches, and so forth. And he just kind of reframes it. I have my own frame, and then he reframes it. And he said, I'm the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even though he dies, yet shall he live, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. So your greatest need is not for you to get back your dead brother, Lazarus. Your greatest need is me. I'm the resurrection and the life. The most important relationship, according to a Christian worldview, is my relationship with God. And that, guys, it just makes sense. If I don't have a relationship with God, I lose everything. I eternally suffer if I don't have a relationship with God. So the most important relationship, the most important one that I have to have above all, and he does everything in this life to push us toward that one relationship as the fountain from which all others can be blessed. He reframes this, our greatest need is him. I'm the resurrection life. Do you believe this? That's the most important thing. This is so central to Christianity. And she says, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Messiah, the Son of God who comes in the world. So here, she gets it. And she knows and she understands and there's a breakthrough. Having said this, she went back and called her sister, Mary, saying in private, the teacher's here and calling for you. Because she wants her to get the breakthrough. As soon as Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. The Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw that Mary got up quickly and went out. They followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to cry there. As soon as Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and told him, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her crying, and the Jews who had come with her crying, he was deeply moved in his spirit and troubled. Where have you put him? He asked. Lord, they told him, come and see. And they took him to the tomb of Lazarus, which, by the way, you can visit today still. And then we get the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. What do I learn from this? Jesus fully enters into our suffering. These were not fake tears. Jesus knew that he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead. But he's not only fully God, he's fully human. And he has fully entered into our humanity. And the word there, deeply troubled, it suggests not only sadness, but also anger and rage. He's like, he's upset and mad at what the ravages of sin have done in this world. And it just ticks him off. Look at what's happened to this place. And he's also sad, terribly saddened by this. It's not one or the other, it's both and. And it's just, this is heartbreaking. And he's pouring out his tears because he loves Lazarus and his sisters, Mary and Martha. He cares about them too. And the whole thing is just upsetting and it's real. This is the God we worship as Christians. The God who cries with us. Not far, some far off distant deity, but who enters into the pain and suffering. And he's there with us and he cries with us. You gotta get that part. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. They got it. But some of them said, couldn't he who opened the blind man's eyes also have kept this man from dying? Here's what I learned here. Some see love and some find fault. And folks, you will always come to the fork in the road, and the Bible is clear about this. You come to the fork in the road, and you can see love and the goodness and the mercy, or you can find fault. Hey, this isn't the way it should be, and God should have done it differently, and so forth. And that you're consistently going to come to that fork in the road. Bible just puts that out there. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and the stone was lying against it. Remove the stone, Jesus said. Martha, the dead man's sisters, told him, Lord, there is already a stench because he has been dead 4 years. King James says, Lord, by this time he stinketh. Yes, he does. He's really dead. Jesus said to her, didn't I tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you heard me. I know that you always hear me, but because of the crowd standing here, I said this so that they may believe you sent me. What is the purpose of the resurrection? It is not only to bring Lazarus back to life. It is to point us to believe in Jesus. That's the end game. After he said this, he shouted with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The dead man came out, bound hand and foot with linen strips and his face wrapped in a cloth. And Jesus said to them, unwrap him and let him go. Here's what I learned here. Jesus is the one who has the last word on suffering and death. He's not powerless. He's over it. He has the last word on suffering and death. It does not defeat him. It does not triumph over him. He overcomes. Now, mind you, this was an exceptional case in which Lazarus was raised from the dead. Eventually, Lazarus would then die a natural death. And there were thousands of people, of course, in Jesus' day that were not raised from the dead. But he shows this to say, I got the final word on this. Verse 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done, tattling on Jesus. So the chief priests and the Pharisees convened the Sanhedrin and were saying, what are we going to do about this since this man is doing so many signs? This guy is raising dead people now. We've got a problem. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So they were concerned about this short-term little situation that wasn't going to go well for them, and their power would be gone. Meanwhile, somebody's raising people from the dead, and they're upset about that. What a bad thing to do for people. What? How upside down can you get? But that's what happened. One of them, Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all. Correct. Verse 50, you're not considering that. And now you need to underline what he now says. The high priest, Caiaphas, who is an enemy of Jesus and who will eventually preside over his trial. It is to your advantage that one man should die for the people rather than the whole nation perish. He just preached the gospel. He didn't know it. He was an enemy of Jesus, but he's saying to all of us here today, it is to your advantage that one man should die rather than all of us should perish. That's like John 3:16. And Caiaphas is saying it. In fact, John notes this. He goes on to say, he did not say this on his own, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation. And not only for the nation only, but also to unite the scattered children of God so all of us could be a part of that as well. You with me? So he tells us the gospel. And guys, here's the part of the Christian story you must get. Write it down. Jesus suffers and dies for us. How can a loving God allow so much suffering? Well, that same loving God sent one man to die in our place and suffered the most painful form of execution and torture ever devised by humanity, death by crucifixion. And it wasn't just the physical death, but the spiritual agony of having the sins of the world laid upon him. This is all our belief and the teaching of Jesus. It's all poured out on Jesus at the cross, and he suffers and he dies for us. He dies for you. He dies for me. Without that, we don't have any hope at all. Unless there's the suffering of Jesus, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Suffering is absolutely essential, but the good news, this loving God so loved the world that he gave his only one and only son, and he died for our sins. This is at the heart and soul. He loved us that much and suffered that much and died for us. He is the wounded healer. He is not just a healer. He himself carries the wounds. He was pierced for our transgressions. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his stripes, we are healed. This is the heart and soul of Christianity, the suffering of Jesus. Lastly, Christianity embraces suffering. In fact, it requires it. Christianity embraces suffering. In fact, it requires it. Christianity doesn't run away and like, oh, that's scary, suffering, don't ask us that question. No. It says this is the whole heart and soul of our faith. It's a cornerstone upon which it's built. If you don't have suffering, you don't have salvation. If Jesus doesn't die on the cross, then we don't have anything. We have no hope. If we don't have a relationship with God, we'll endlessly suffer. This puts an end to the suffering if we believe and trust in him, ultimately. And then Christianity not only embraces suffering, it requires it. Jesus has the audacity to say to me and to you, oh, you want to come after me? Then you daily deny yourself, take up your cross, the instrument of execution, and follow me. This is the path of suffering. This is what the Christian life is about. Paul said, if anyone wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus, he will be persecuted. Paul writes, he says, it has been granted to you, a gift to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him. He says, it's a gift. You not only get to trust in him, you suffer for him. It is the heart and soul of our faith. We're not running from it. It's in your face. It's saying like, this is what we do as followers of Jesus. It's part of the process. How could a loving God allow so much suffering? Atheism says, well, he doesn't exist and that's why we suffer. For something to be true, it has to match with, it has to be internally consistent, it has to match with reality. So let's say the hand is reality. Atheism says, no, there's no purpose or meaning. You're just an accident. It's meaningless. There is no design, right? Did we ask this already, if you had a cell phone? Do you have a cell phone? How many of you have a cell phone? Did that just happen? Did somebody design that? Right? Yeah, of course. You come along and see something that has a design, it must have a designer. It's the same way. I mean, you look around the trees and the mountains, your brain, your heart, your physical body, your thoughts, your soul, there's a design to it. That's because there's a designer. So atheism doesn't work. Buddhism says just detach yourself from this. And yet we miss out on all these important realities that give life meaning. So then Christianity says, here's the hand. And you're not going to get all of the answers, but you're going to get like the palm. Okay, this is how much God's going to reveal to us. There's still going to be some that aren't there. You're still going to have a few questions. I've got a question. But you got enough for him to have the whole world in his hand. He's got the whole world in his hand. He's got you and me, brother, you and me, sister, in his hand. He's got the whole world in his hand. I believe that. And I truly believe the Christian worldview makes the most sense of the suffering than any other worldview. Still some mysteries, of course, because we're finite people. Some of you know that Ruth and I have been kind of walking through a path the last few months. If you don't know, or if just as a reminder, 5 months ago, Ruth was diagnosed with chondrosarcoma, which is a very rare form of bone cancer. And we were told that she would have to have this malignant tumor removed. That was a very difficult surgery. And that she would have to be removed. It would have to be removed. And so 5 months ago, we were told that. 40 days ago, Ruth had a major surgery. She had that malignant tumor removed, and she is cancer-free now. We spent 18 days at the University of Iowa Hospital as she recovered and struggled and managed pain. We came back to Des Moines. She's in a rehab. They entered into a rehab facility. And for 2 weeks, she went through a little bit of rehab. Mind you, because of this wound on her right side, she has to remain on her left side, laying on her left side always. She cannot put any weight on this right side still. So she's laying in bed at the rehab place 22 out of 24 hours a day. On her left side. She started feeling bad. She was sent back to Mercy Hospital, where it was discovered that she had a blood clot in her knee and also a large abscess that would need to be surgically removed. She was there at Mercy for a week. When a bed opened up finally at the University of Iowa, we went over there last Wednesday, and she had 2 days ago that abscess removed. It's about 2 liters of this infected fluid. Another surgery. on her side about 23 and a half hours out of 24 hours a day. And eventually this week, we, Lord willing, she'll return back to Des Moines. She'll have she'll be on an IV antibiotics for the next 6 weeks. And then the long term is that you'll have, according to the orthopedic surgeon, you'll be in a walker for a year. And then hopefully you'll graduate to a cane, because they removed half of her right pelvis also to get this cancer. And then one leg is going to be shorter than the other. And you're going to have an instability on this right side. And so after about 2 years, you'll kind of know what your new normal is. And we're hopeful that, you know, you're going to have, you know, with that cane, and, you know, there's going to be some strengthening and scarring and muscle and so forth. And here's a picture of my bride yesterday. I'm kind of commuting from Iowa City back here just to drop in. There she is. And through all of this, rejoicing in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. My wife, Ruth Steve. What do you do about this, guys? And by the way, we've been in hospitals long enough and rehab places to know that many people have far worse situations than we do. Many. And then there's emotional hardships that people face that are unthinkable to us. What do we do? I'll tell you what we do. We take out Quentin's old sermon notes and we say, suffering is real. God loves people. Just go through the list, filter it through. We expect God to do something about it. God is sovereign and has a design purpose. Mysteriously, God sometimes loves us through delay. Jesus is all powerful. Death is real. God's ultimate goal is for us to fully trust in him. Some people are realistic downers. Sometimes Jesus doesn't come when we want, but there's hope in suffering, but sometimes it seems far off. Jesus reframes our suffering. Our greatest need is him. Jesus fully enters into our suffering. Some see love and some find fault. Jesus has the last word on our suffering and death. Jesus suffers and dies for us. And Christianity embraces suffering. In fact, he requires it. Father, we love you. We love you. You are a good God. And there are mysteries that I do not understand. But Lord, you're teaching us to rejoice in suffering, to be pray constantly, rejoice always, and give thanks in every circumstances, in all circumstances. I pray today for somebody here who's really having a hard time. God, show up in their life, enter in, let them know you care and love them, that this isn't the end. It's just part of a story that we are in the middle of, and this is not the final chapter. Would you show your presence to them? Would you show your love to them? Would you strengthen them? Would you give them joy? Would you give them wisdom? Would you give them a smile like the awesome Ruth Steve? And for the skeptic, oh God, I pray you would open their eyes to see the grand and glorious story of your love, that it is good news. It really is good news, and it's true. And all God's people agreed and said,